Enron was truly a trial of the century. It had everything: massive egos, bigger-than-life lawyers, and a massive fraud. On this special series from the Compliance Podcast Network, Tom Fox is joined by Lauren Steffi, who was a business journalist while it was all happening. Tune in for his reflections and new insights on the first trial of the century for the 21st century.
This is Tom Fox. I hope you will join me for my five-part exploration of the Enron trial and its legacy, together with former Houston Chronicle business columnist Lauren Steffi, as we look back at Lauren's reflections on reporting on the Enron trial. In episode 4, we take a look at the verdict, what happened when the verdict was announced, what were the counts the defendants found guilty on, and what were they looking at in terms of jail time, what was the jail time Jeff Skilling actually served versus what he was sentenced to, Ken Lay and his death shortly after the verdict came out, and how that, the impact of his death on guilty verdict against him. We look at those who were in the courtroom and their reactions to the verdict in the Enron trial. I hope you will join me for this penultimate episode 4 of this 5-part podcast series. I know you will enjoy it.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox back with episode 4 in our 5-part series on Enron the trial. Once again, joined by Lauren Steffi. Lauren, first of all, welcome back.
Thanks again, Tom. Always good to be here.
So, Lauren, today we're going to take up the verdict. I was actually in the Harris County courtroom when the Texaco verdict came back, which was $11 billion against Texaco, Pennzoil Texaco case. And that was about as electric a verdict as I've ever seen. But what was the tension? What was the feel? You know, was your skin crawling? What was it like to be in the courtroom when the judge announced the verdict?
You know, I have a confession to make. I wasn't actually in the courtroom when we realized they had reached a verdict. You know, it came early on, I believe it was a Friday morning, as I recall. I was actually working at home. You know, as a columnist, I had the privilege of sort of setting my own hours to some extent. So I would often work from home, wait for the traffic to die down, and then go into the office. And so I was still at home. And the way we had this set up was we had reporters in the courtroom on kind of a rotating basis. And when there was an indication that a verdict had been reached, they were supposed to let us all know. Well, of course, as you can imagine, that created a mad scramble. Everybody was, you know, all excited. They forgot to let me know. And so what happened was I got a call from one of the TV networks. I think it was MSNBC or somebody like that. I answer the phone. And they're like, it's MSNBC. Please hold. And then there's just like dead silence. And I'm like, well, the only reason they'd be calling me is because there's a verdict, right? So I start racing around, getting my stuff together and drive down to the courthouse. So I literally walk in like kind of right as all this is unfolding. But it was a surreal experience because, you know, you had 5 months invested in this, like, you know, almost every day being in court, watching, you know, listening to all this testimony, hearing all this stuff and really being, you know, very, very involved in the case. And then suddenly it's over. And, you know, the actual reading of the verdicts was, you know, I think it took less than half an hour, within 20 minutes or so to go through the whole thing. And then it was like, you know, kind of almost a letdown. I mean, there was another week or so of a separate sort of mini trial involving Lay and some bank fraud stuff. But it, you know, it was kind of like this almost surreal experience. And where it really hit home for me was we walked upstairs. There was a press conference, or I guess it was at a hotel across the street or something. And I walk in and this woman walks up to me with a copy of the verdict and asks me if I'll sign it for her. You know, would you sign a copy of the verdict? And I was like, this is just so bizarre. I mean, it was a weird day. And I remember getting back to the newsroom and working on the column and really, you know, when as a writer, when you're trying to sort of encapsulate all of this stuff that you spent all this time processing, you know, I was trying to find just what I wanted to say, because this is my last shot, right, at the whole Enron thing. And I knew they were holding space on the front page. My columns didn't get on the front page that often. So there was a lot of pressure. I think I might have busted deadline a little bit on that column, trying to get it just right. But ultimately, it did make it on the front page. So
well, let's go into a little bit of detail on the counts and what the verdicts were. Could you maybe go through those and really speak to the significance of each count?
Okay, so when the verdict came down, you know, Skilling had been convicted on 19 counts, and his were all related to conspiracy and fraud. And then Lay was because Lay also had a couple of bank fraud and making false statements to banks, which were added on there. So combined, Lay was looking at 120 years in prison total, and Skilling was something like 185 years altogether from all these different counts. Obviously, Skilling served a lot less than that. He was actually sentenced to 17, I believe, and then it got reduced to 12. And then Lay, of course, died before the sentencing. And so the verdict was actually vacated for him.
So I remember, I think it was your story, but stories about the trial lawyers, both prosecution and the defense, after the verdict came in. And not so much their press conference remarks, but sort of the either celebratory or not celebratory dinners and the kind of atmospheres on both. And I just remember Petrocelli just couldn't believe that they came back with a guilty verdict. Really any sense of how both teams felt about the verdict?
Yeah, I think the defense team really was stunned. I mean, I think that the attorneys as well as the defendants believed that they were going to get, you know, a not guilty verdict. Obviously, the prosecution was in a much more celebratory mood. I mean, this was a really uphill battle from a prosecution standpoint in many ways. And I think, you know, a trial of this magnitude with this much national and international interest, really, there was a great sense of relief, but also a tremendous sense of accomplishment on the part of the prosecution. But yeah, you know, by this point in the trial, I mean, I thought it was very interesting watching the defense and how they kind of reacted to this. I mean, Petrocelli was very down. For a guy who had been upbeat all through the trial, he was clearly disappointed and I think very surprised by the outcome. Skilling was a little more stoic. And I think you kind of saw that through the whole process after that. I mean, he was kind of a model inmate in prison, and there were a few stories here and there that seemed to indicate he had kind of, while he may not have agreed with the verdict or may not have agreed that he did anything wrong, he sort of accepted his fate in many ways. And of course, he is now out of prison and apparently working on a new energy deal. So,
did you have any sense, or did the jurors give any remarks, formal, informal, to indicate how they felt having sat through this sort of almost mind-numbing detail for 5 months, or any sense of the jurors' experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think the jurors really deserve a lot of credit because it was a very, very long trial, and these are people that put their lives on hold for months on end. I mean, they weren't sequestered, but they were. It still made it very difficult to work. I mean, I remember, you know, at least one of them was a teacher. You know, I mean, that's, you got to get a long-term sub for that one if you're picked as a juror in the Enron trial. But I think they did a really good job of sort of listening to the arguments and considering them. And the one comment that one of the jurors made that always stuck with me was they were asked about Fastow and his testimony, and which I thought was very credible in many ways. But the juror was very, kind of waved his hand. He's like, Fastow was Fastow. You know, it was sort of like that didn't really factor into their decision nearly as much as we thought it would when we were watching all of it unfold.
One thing we haven't talked about is the judge. Could you give us a sense of the judge? Was he really very judicial? Did he have to kind of keep the lawyers in check from going into lawyer histrionics? Or did you feel like he ran a fair trial? What was your just sense of the judge?
Yeah, and keep in mind, I mean, again, I was in the overflow room most of the time, so I couldn't actually see the judge during the trial. But yeah, I think he did really have he certainly understood the magnitude of the case, you know. And as you know, as a lawyer, you know, judges, they have to factor that in, right? I mean, this was a case that was going to get a lot of scrutiny. There was a very good chance it was going to be appealed. And so I think he tried to be very, very careful in his administration of the case. He didn't want there to be any sort of mistakes that could lead to a mistrial, or, you know, you can't afford that in a case of this magnitude. And so I do think he was very careful. I think for the most part, the lawyers were pretty well behaved. So there wasn't a lot of, you know, sort of courtroom management, I guess, from that standpoint. It was almost as if everyone involved really understood that this was a really, really big trial and they were playing on the big stage.
And maybe I'd like to end this episode by asking you about kind of your experience of not simply reporting this case, but writing a column about it, giving your opinion, leading up to the final column, and how you were able to sort of encapsulate everything you were hearing, seeing, perhaps even some people were smelling, into a readable column that frankly, from my perspective, I couldn't wait to read your column every day. That's after having read the wrap-ups of the trial.
Well, it was a lot of fun, and I don't know that there had ever been a case where a columnist covered a trial like this day in, day out. I mean, I was writing three columns a week, so not every one of those columns every week was going to be about Enron, but it was obviously something that people in Houston were very focused on, very interested in, and I think probably at least once a week, I had a column about something that happened at the trial. What I tried to do, because we had, you know, we had teams of reporters covering what was happening in the courtroom, I was always trying to look for that sort of thing that you could take away from the testimony, you know, sort of the analysis, if you will, or the context or perspective, something that you weren't getting from the news stories. And, you know, a lot of it is the kinds of things we've been talking about on this podcast, but that was something that really resonated with people. And, you know, there were times where things came out that were just absurd, you know, when Skilling made certain assertions about not being aware of things that were going on or whatever. I thought part of my job was to basically call him out on that. And I kind of actually came up with a little catchphrase in my column. I called it Planet Skilling. You know, whenever we entered that realm where it was this kind of weird, unique logic that he employed, you know, it seemed like it was from a different world. And I think that was the thing I tried to do through the trial, was sort of step back from it and just say, no, in the real world, this doesn't happen. This doesn't make sense. And so that was, I think, part of what kept people engaged. Was it was kind of a running commentary almost on what was happening in the courtroom.
Well, unfortunately, we are near the end of our time for this episode, but I hope our listeners will join us for our fifth and final episode next time, where we really take a look back, and I'm going to ask you about some of your reflections on what it all might mean even today. So I look forward to wrapping up this series in our next episode.
Thanks a lot.
This is Tom Fox. In episode 4 of Trial of the Century, the Enron trial, we looked at the verdict and what it was like to be in the courtroom when the verdict was delivered. Lauren gave his thoughts on what he felt when the verdict came in, and he said it was almost surreal. And part of it was because the trial had lasted so many months, and it came to an end simply just like that. Jeff Skilling was convicted on 19 counts with looking at, I believe, 186 years in prison. Ken Lay was looking at 120 years in prison. Ken Lay died within a couple of weeks after the trial, and under federal criminal procedure, if you die before you have the chance to appeal, the guilty verdict against you is vacated. So the guilty verdict against Ken Lay was vacated. But of course, Jeff Skilling was sentenced to 18 years in jail, later reduced to 12 years in a deal with the Department of Justice, and he's now released from prison. So there was significant jail time for Jeff Skilling, and there would have been for Ken Lay, assuming his guilty verdict was also upheld on appeal. But Lauren really said it continued to be surreal. This went on in the press conference afterwards. He mentioned that someone came up to him with a copy of the verdict and asked him to sign it. He'd never been asked to sign anything like that. And that really led to him just having a sense of surrealness. He talked about how both the prosecutors and the defense team reacted, not so much in the courtroom after the verdict. They were relatively stoic, as most lawyers are at the time a verdict is announced. But afterwards, both the defendants and the defense team seemed truly shocked that fraud was going on at Enron, and they got caught at it. And Petrocelli particularly couldn't understand how the jury came to its decision. The prosecutors were more circumspect. Lauren thought they did a very good job on a very tough set of facts, but their remarks were somewhat tempered. Nevertheless, they were clearly the winners in this event, in this trial. The courtroom was the home of the jurors for obviously several months. The jury was not sequestered, but their lives were clearly disrupted. And Lauren talked about a teacher who had to find a substitute teacher for months at a time for her school. But he really applauded the jury as the true heroes of this story, who sat through attentively hours of testimony about the intricacies and minutiae of accounting and accounting fraud. And he thought they did an admirable job. He talked about the judge and how the judge seemed to understand immediately the gravity of holding a trial of the century in his courtroom, and how the judge managed the courtroom well, obviously with a relatively error-prone trial, which withstood appeal, at least the appeal of Jeff Skilling. The lawyers themselves also seemed to understand the seriousness and historic nature of the event. Lawrence said there was not too many lawyer histrionics and that the court didn't have to engage in a lot of lawyer management that you see now, and that everyone did their job. They did their jobs admirably. They were all really at the best of their games, and that at the end of the day, it was the facts of the case that won out, added with the, not legacy of Enron, but the really the people cost, the damage that Kinlay and Jeff Skilling wrought from their accounting fraud and misrepresentations to investors in the market. We talked earlier about some of the most poignant testimony at trial came from individuals who were damaged by the actions of Lay and Skilling, and that seemed to be one of the key turning points. The fifth and final episode, which will be our next episode, is we're going to look at the legacy of Enron and the trial of the century, the Enron trial, some 15 years later. I hope you'll join us for our fifth and final episode.